Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again, this is Jay Shapiro. Thanks for listening. This week I'm going to discuss a number of topics that I can only touch upon superficially because of time limitation and the fact that this program is only once a week. But these are topics that I think are quite important, and I suggest to the listeners they follow up on these topics on their own. One is the fact that the United States Embassy was moved to Jerusalem by the Trump administration just a few years ago. Until that time, with few exceptions having to do with geographical reasons, the American Embassy is always located in the capital of the country with which it has diplomatic relations, and there were U.S. consulates in other cities outside the capital. Similarly, Israel has an embassy in Washington, the capital of the United States, and consulates in other cities where convenient. Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Israel's capital. Now, the United States, under the Biden administration, is speaking of opening a U.S. consulate in Jerusalem to serve the Palestinian population. This is an attack on Israeli sovereignty and cannot be allowed. This is an issue that bears watching. Another topic is the growing relations between Israel and a number of countries in Africa, mostly Muslim. Israel had relations with these countries many years ago, but they were suspended under pressure from the Arab League. Now they're being reintroduced to the benefit of both Israel and these countries. These are the main themes of my program. However, I also want to mention that Israel will soon establish relations with Comoros. I had to look it up on the map. It's an island nation in the Indian Ocean near Africa. It has only 719 square miles, a population of 850,886, and half the population is... It's a Muslim country. Half the population is under international poverty line of $1.25 a day. But it's important because now it's a country, another country, and the UN General Assembly that has relations with Israel. And that's good news. I'll be back after the break.
How did a nice Jewish girl from Delaware end up living in Israel?
Shalom, I'm Natalie Zapinski. Join me on my show, Returning Home. Meet different people who have moved to Israel. Hear their personal stories, their highs, their lows, and everything in between. Each week, we talk to experts on immigration and the process of moving to Israel. Listen to Returning Home every Thursday, only on Israel News Talk Radio.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. On this segment of the program, I want to talk about a subject which is so far under the headlines, but it may develop and it could bring about the breakup of our present government here in Israel. What I'm discussing is the American Embassy. From the time the State of Israel was established until President Trump, the American Embassy was in Tel Aviv, and it was the consulate in Jerusalem that primarily served the Palestinians. Now, President Trump changed that, and it's interesting also that Israel had been, to the best of my knowledge, the only country in the world where the embassy was not in the capital. the way it's the Americans had it until Trump was that the embassy was in Tel Aviv, which is not the capital. And it's questionable whether it's any longer the largest city. Jerusalem has grown. But it, Trump closed the embassy in Tel Aviv and moved it to Jerusalem. And he closed the consul to the Palestinians in Jerusalem. So now there is only one embassy here in Jerusalem and no consulates, American consulates, anywhere else. When the American embassy was open in Jerusalem, which was the consulate, which is superfluous in unified Jerusalem, was closed. Now, the Palestinian Authority wants the U.S. to reopen the consulate in Jerusalem because for them it means that Jerusalem is being redivided, something which, of course, we will not recognize. Now, certainly, much of the international community would see the opening of a U.S. consulate as the Palestinian Authority sees it, which would have a detrimental impact on Jerusalem as the status as Israel's united capital. Now, all too often, decisions taken by world leaders have ramifications far broader than intended. As I said, well, U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is talking about reopening the U.S. consulate. The Palestinian Authority sees it as redividing Jerusalem, an act that would incidentally violate American law. Now, what is the American law? I want to get a little bit technical, but I think it's important for the listeners to know the details. There's something called the U.S. Jerusalem Embassy Act, repeatedly stresses the unity and indivisibility of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And in this Jerusalem Embassy Act, which was, I think, in 1995, passed in the U.S. Congress, it said the following. In 1967, the city of Jerusalem was reunited during the conflict known as the Six-Day War. Jerusalem has been a united city administered by Israel, and it should remain an undivided city, recognized as the capital of the State of Israel. That's what the U.S. Embassy Act says. Now, the Palestinian Authority obviously sees opening the consulate in Jerusalem as a rejection of all these statutes in American law. Explaining the international implications of the U.S. reopening the consulate, the Palestinian Authority Prime Minister stated that the move is important for Palestinians because the message from the Biden administration is that Jerusalem is not one united Israeli city and that the American administration does not recognize the annexation of Arab Jerusalem by the Israeli side. We want the American consulate to constitute the seat of a U.S. embassy in the state of Palestine. So that's what the head of the Palestinian Authority, the prime minister, said. In other words, it's obvious to everybody to open a consulate in addition to the embassy in Israel's capital is a foot in the door by the Palestinian Authority to split the city. Now, redividing Jerusalem should not be the U.S. intention. Jerusalem Embassy Act, which was goes back to 1995, postponed by subsequent U.S. presidents to protect the national security interests of the United States. In other words, I think it was every 5 years, The Americans said we can't, the American administration said we can't move the Jerusalem embassy, the embassy to Jerusalem according to the act, because it has implications that are not good for America and might cause troubles. All right, this went on for every 5 years until the Trump administration and Donald Trump in 2017 stipulated the U.S. must move the U.S. embassy in Israel to the reunited, undivided Jerusalem. That was the words of Trump's statement. Significantly, the Jerusalem Embassy Act explained that declaring Jerusalem the United Capital of Israel was merely recognized what was already its authentic status. According to that Jerusalem Embassy Act, and I quote, each sovereign nation under international law and custom may designate its own capital. Since 1950, the city of Jerusalem has been the capital of the state of Israel. From 1948 to 1967, Jerusalem was the divided city, and Israeli citizens of all faiths, as well as Jewish citizens of all states, were denied access to the holy sites in the area controlled by Jordan. In 1967, the city of Jerusalem was reunited. Jerusalem has been a united city administered by Israel, and persons of all religious faiths have been guaranteed full access to holy sites. The United States conducts official meetings and other businesses in the city of Jerusalem in de facto recognition of its status as the capital of Israel. In 1996, the State of Israel will celebrate the 3,000th anniversary of the Jewish presence in Jerusalem since King David's entry. Jerusalem should remain an undivided city. Jerusalem be recognized as the capital of the State of Israel. What I've been quoting in the last minute or two is the U.S. Embassy Act passed by Congress. In other words, U.S. law is saying that recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital was not only to acknowledge its de facto status, but also recognize its Jewish history. In addition, the Embassy Act notes that from 1948 to 1967, part of the city was under Jordanian control and not Palestinian. The PA, the Palestinian Authority, wants the U.S. to reopen the consulate in Jerusalem because for them, it means that Jerusalem is being redivided. So obviously, much of the international community would see the opening of a U.S. consulate as the Palestinian Authority sees it, which would have a detrimental impact on the city of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So at this moment, it is unclear whether the U.S. Biden administration intends to undermine the goal of American law that was passed back in 1995. However, even if the U.S. does not intend to declare that it is redividing Jerusalem to reopen a U.S. consulate, we're in a situation where actions speak louder than intentions. In other words, opening a consulate in Israel's capital city, where the Americans already have an embassy, would essentially be a statement by the U.S. administration that Jerusalem can be divided. Israel considers Jerusalem its capital, and you do not open up a consulate in addition to an embassy in the capital city of a foreign country. So, if our government gives into this, then there's no doubt that there will be a crisis here in Israel. I don't know if there are many people, whether religious or irreligious or secular or what, who would agree to the redivision of the city of Jerusalem and handing over part of it to a Palestinian state, which is not come into being yet, as a matter of fact. The Palestinians are unable to get their act together to begin with. And so there's really not one Palestinian voice facing Israel. Matter of fact, It's been quite a time since the Palestinians have even agreed to negotiate anything with Israel. So that's the situation right now, and it may become aggravated by the... This is developing into a very complicated situation, and it may, as I said, cause a breakdown and the fall of our own government. It is a major issue we cannot compromise on. I'll be back after the break.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro, and on this segment, I want to speak about another subject which has been under the radar. And that is the relationship between Israel and a number of states in Africa. But the modern state of Israel is the only nation in history that has delivered people of Africa from slavery to freedom and not the other way around. It was back in the 1990s, and I remember it was on a Saturday, a Sabbath, when plane loads of Jews from Ethiopia were brought to Israel to save them from starvation. Now, this stands in contrast to so many others who exploited the African people and plundered their land, and they still do today in some cases. The European countries did that for about a century and a half. And needless to say, it was a source of slaves for many countries, including the United States. Now, when Israel was revived as a modern Jewish state in 1948, the then Foreign Minister Golda Meir wanted Israel to offer African countries a helping hand as they, the African countries, discarded the shackles of colonialism. Now, that's part of modern political Zionism, and the father of Zionism, political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, was deeply sympathetic to the plight of the African people and the need for the Jews to help them once they themselves became liberated. So Golda Meir, was determined to bring his sentiment to fruition. She, Golda Meir, saw the compelling need for Israel to provide assistance to these newly independent nations, even though the new Jewish nation was struggling to help itself, but the others in Africa were in worse shape. So this commitment spanned a large area from agriculture to infrastructure. Israel built airports, they set up shipping operations, they established educational and training institutions in African countries. Thousands of Israeli experts traveled around Africa to offer knowledge and advice and assistance. And numerous African leaders traveled to Israel, got educated here, they saw innovation, and they saw what Israel was doing, and it spurred them to help their own countries. All in all, until 1973, until the war, a total of 33 African countries received help from Israel when it was most needed, when they were really in their infancy as independent countries. The Arab League, which is extremely hostile toward a Jewish state, pressured the Organization of African Unity to sabotage and cut off ties with Israel on the pretext that Israel had occupied African land. Where? In the Suez area. The Suez Canal, they said, was African land, and Israel had occupied it back in 1973. Now, obviously, Israel was disappointed by this, but it turned out it was devastating for the African continent in multiple ways. It could be that Africa could have had a very different economy today had it developed with the help of Israel, who was educating and liberating and freed its own people and the rest of the world. But it succumbed to political pressure from the Organization of African Unity. They broke off ties with Israel, and their development actually stopped. Now, in the past few years, Israel and Africa have been coming closer again because of the pragmatic leadership in Africa. A lot of the ideologues are gone, and there are renewed efforts by Israel to rekindle the connection. In the past year, Israel has made peace with North African countries like Morocco and Sudan that until recently were long-standing foes of Israel. Now, this has spiked trade and investment, with Morocco benefiting from a 40% increase in trade in Israel in this past year alone. Exports between Israel and Morocco are predicted to increase tenfold over the next few years, bringing world-leading innovation and technology along with investment into these African countries. Now, business sectors, believe it or not, are already reaping the benefits of collaborative efforts with Israel, which include the development of smart cities in Africa, digital health technology, agricultural cooperation. Direct flights have been launched between Marrakesh and Tel Aviv, and so far 20,000 Israeli tourists are predicted to visit Morocco each year, bringing millions of dollars annually to their economy. And I myself, before the pandemic, visited Morocco. It was a fascinating visit. These developments are transformational for these countries, making a direct impact on the lives of individuals and families, besides the country as a whole in Africa. Now, drought leading to famine is Africa's biggest challenge. Southern Africa has been in the midst of famine about every 3 years. So countries like Zimbabwe and Angola and Madagascar are in trouble because of this. The East Africa is predicted to see extreme drought in the next 5 years in places like Ethiopia, Somalia, and Kenya. This could lead to malnutrition or starvation for millions of people. Few nations in the world can match the kind of assistance that Israel can provide. Israel is a world leader in water technology. Israel has proven how water scarcity can be turned into abundance by tapping underground reservoirs and the ocean. Nonprofit projects in thousands of villages across Africa already use Israeli water technology to sustain millions of people. Israel's solar technology provides power to schools and hospitals today in Africa, including powering mobile devices for connectivity, research, information, and commerce. Given these dynamics on the ground, it was fitting and long overdue that in July of this year, Israel was given observer status at the African Union by the Commission Chairman. Over 70 countries have observation status, some being former colonizers of Africa, some who do little but plunder African resources, or they entangle themselves in African diplomacy, and many who have bear atrocious records on human rights abuses of their own. Israel is free of all these backgrounds. So observer status simply means that a country may be invited to attend some meetings, then again limited access to documents, but they don't hold any voting rights in the African Union. So when any other country besides Israel received observer status, few cared or even noticed. But when Israel was awarded the symbolic title of observer at the African Union, the anti-Israel machinery went into action. And this was largely supported and driven by South Africa, whose opposition to Israel is based, so-called, on solidarity with the Palestinians. Unfortunately, this one-sided position ignores the Palestinians' refusal to recognize, negotiate, or make peace with Israel, as well as they support terrorism, which Africa has also suffered from. In truth, many African states now see diminishing returns from making solidarity speeches on the Palestinian issue because it brings little benefit to the Arab world. So which the Arab world itself is opening up to Israel. So the Palestinian issue is simply a means of diverting attention from domestic problems in Africa, and they're going to get wise to this. Israel deserves observer status in Africa, so it's hopeful now that Africa will continue to invest in its own future through an important friendship with Israel. Israel is not a mere observer to happenings on the African continent, but it's a longtime partner with a history of helping Africa. So it's pretty much in the African Union's interest to recognize and ensure that this continues. Again, this is something that's under the headlines, but I want the listeners to be aware. You can follow up these things in the news, though it generally doesn't appear in the headlines or on the front pages. But Israel is an important ally to Africa. Hopefully, this relationship will grow with advantages to the recipients and to the receivers. I'll be back after the break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Ben-Tekoa. Each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words that I saw were written by Barry Weiss. Barry Weiss is a journalist who quit the New York Times recently, and she wrote the New York Times a huge letter describing why she quit. And she quit under what's called constructive dismissal. It's also called constructive discharge or constructive termination. That's a fancy word. What's it all mean? This occurs when an employee resigns as a result of the employer creating a hostile work environment because the resignation was not truly voluntary. It is, in effect, a termination. For example, when an employer places extraordinary and unreasonable work demands on an employee to obtain their resignation, this is called a constructive dismissal. The exact legal consequences differ between different countries. But generally, a constructive dismissal leads to the employee's obligations ending and the employee acquiring the right to make claims against the employer. So I just give this definition, something I had never heard of, but then when I read some things written by Barry Weiss, and one of the things said that she left the New York Times under the conditions of constructive dismissal. Now, I want to repeat here what she said because I think that's what is of interest. She's Jewish, and she wrote a letter recently, and she said, if you study history and if you look at where Jews stand in the culture, for better or usually for worse, you will understand where a culture, where a civilization stands, whether it's on the way up, whether it's on the way down, whether it's expanding its freedoms or whether it's contracting them. And this is because the Jews represent freedom. Where liberty thrives, where freedom thrives, Jews thrive. Where difference is celebrated genuinely, Jews are celebrated. Where freedom of thought and faith and speech are protected, Jews tend to be protected also. And when such virtues are regarded as threats, then it shouldn't surprise us that Jews are regarded as threats also. We are living in a culture today increasingly in which difference, in which disagreement, in which diversity of thought, in which thinking free and out loud is regarded as heretical and dangerous. One might imagine, as those other times and faces did, that the solution then is to erase our differences, to play our differences down, to try to get along, to go along with the stream. But the very, very opposite is true. And Judaism itself offers the perfect antidote for what's happening today. So she went on to say she attended a Talmud class. Now, some imagine that the American Supreme Court is the first place where minority opinions get written down and recorded for posterity. However, the Talmud is a 2,000-year-old debate, and it's essentially a record of debate. It's a debate between sages born hundreds of years apart, talking to each other on exactly the same page. And it's not just a document of the majority opinion, the opinion that ended up winning the day. The Talmud is a document of the minority, of the critics, of the gadflies. And the two most ancient names in that ancient book are Hillel and Shammai. And they disagree about just about everything. How to light the Hanukkah candles, where to hang the mezuzah. If you don't know what these words are, they disagreed about everything. But the school of Hillel is the one that wins. And the rabbis ask why. Was it that Hillel was better at arguments? Was it that Hillel had better ideas? No. The reason they give, the reason that the school of Hillel won out is taught first is because the school of Hillel taught the opposing opinion to its students first before it taught its own opinions. It taught the argument of Shammai first. Not only that, the schools of Hillel and the schools of Shammai allowed their children to marry one another, and that essentially defines a civil society. Now, right now, we live in the age of the mob. We live in an era of groupthink, of forced conformity, of ideological hegemony, of black and white purity politics where people are sorted out into good and bad, into black and white, into pure and impure, the community of the righteous, the community of the good, and everybody else. We live in an age of digital book burnings and of the 21st century witch burnings. We don't gather in the public square anymore. We just go on Twitter for that. And I think we live in an era in which everything is seen through the lens of politics, in which nothing, including relationships, fall outside of it. This is all anti-liberal, it is anti-humanist, but however, it is encoded in Judaism DNA. I think it is the counterculture perspective we need on hearing multiple perspectives, on putting reason over passion, of a kind of intellectual humility that understands sometimes the minority opinion turns out to be right. And by the way, that happens in the Talmud also over the years. And at best, this is also what good journalism does. That is why Barry Weiss resigned from the New York Times. It no longer kept its critical eye on the fact that all opinions are legitimate. Some turn out to be wrong, but you have to hear them first. And at least this is also what good journalism does. Good journalism tunes out the mob. It cuts through the noise. It looks beyond the stereotype of competing narrative. It insists on individual dignity, and we look at all sides of the story. Now, this is interesting, by the way. Barry Weiss has become a known person since she quit the New York Times, but she points out something very interesting. You know, she mentions that today with the Supreme Court requires that even a dissenting or a minority opinion is published, because it's really important to know, even though an opinion is not the majority opinion, it's important to know what it is, because there always may be instances later on where in a certain situation, the minority opinion may turn out to be the right opinion for a particular instance. And when, after reading what she wrote, I find it really mind-boggling that she looks to the Talmud. It's a 2,000-year-old debate, and it's a record of debate. Now, a lot of people don't know what the Talmud is. Today, there are a tremendous number of people studying Talmud. There are classes in Talmud all over. There is something called the Daf Yomi. The Talmud contains about 2,700 pages. And close to 100 years ago, back in the 1920s, a rabbi in Poland, Rabbi Meir Shapiro, came up with the idea of people all over the world studying the same page of the Talmud on the same day. And now we're almost 100 years later, and there are people all over the world studying the Talmud. And what they're doing, it is not only bringing us together today, which is fantastic. I flew from Tel Aviv to Los Angeles. A lot of people got off the plane in New York. And after the plane took off to go from New York to Los Angeles, a fellow came over to me and he said, a stranger, I didn't know who he was, came over to me and he said, "You study the Daily Talmud page?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "You have a copy of the Talmud with you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "So do I." He came over, we sat down, and we spent the hours flying from New York to Los Angeles, studying the same page of the Talmud, the 2,000-year-old Talmud. Here, two perfect strangers on a plane, two Jews flying together, had the common page of the Talmud to bring them together. And I think that is an absolutely fantastic thing. So the Talmud doesn't provide final solutions. The Talmud provide the legitimate arguments on all sides of an issue. And I think that's something we have to remind ourselves. People who don't know what the Talmud is, I hope these few minutes that I spent about it will get people interested in knowing what it is. You can find pages on the Talmud on the internet and other places, because it is a way not only of gaining knowledge, not only of learning Jewish history, not only about learning about Judaism, but about relating to fellow Jews today, whether we know them or we don't. And I think that's important. I just wanted to share with the listeners. I'll be back after the break.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.home page, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candlelighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.